This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Budget negotiations continue,
but it's still a bumpy ride to compromise.
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for downloading the podcast from Marketplace.org. It is Thursday, the last day of March.
Coming up, even Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, has to retire. But his heir apparent, Jeremy, is apparently no longer with Berkshire Hathaway.
That's right. And talk about irony. Microsoft accusing someone else of antitrust.
And later, Denny's goes hog wild over one of its menu items.
All that's just
hog wild. Hog wild, Jeremy.
Wait till you hear what the story is. All that's just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
8 days and counting to the next budget deadline in Washington. And if Congress doesn't act before April 8th, which is a week from tomorrow, then the government will shut down. Well, late yesterday, Vice President Joe Biden met with Senate Democratic leaders and said a shutdown could be avoided. Marketplace Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is with us right now. Good morning, John.
Morning, Steve.
Why is this causing such big waves on Wall Street right now?
Well, Berkshire Hathaway is a company that's almost personified by Warren Buffett. It's not unlike Steve Jobs at Apple or Rupert Murdoch at News Corp. In fact, just yesterday we saw Murdoch put his younger son, James, into a position to take over that huge media conglomerate someday. But, you know, the successors to these charismatic corporate leaders always have to struggle, according to Florida State University management professor Wayne Hawkwarter.
Every single move that you make will be scrutinized, everything from hiring a secretary to changing the paper in the copy room. Somebody's going to be looking over one's shoulder saying, you know, that's not the way Warren would have done it.
Yeah. Well, as Berkshire looks ahead, John, for someone else to be next in line, what's next for David Sokol?
He resigned, he says, to devote more time to his philanthropic work, but it's possible that securities regulators will come calling. He bought millions of dollars worth of stock in that chemical company before recommending that Berkshire buy it. And some say that he used his inside knowledge to cash in.
All right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. John, thanks.
Thank you.
Now to some surprising news from one of the nation's most respected companies. The man who was positioned to succeed the 80-year-old investor Warren Buffett at Berkshire Hathaway has resigned. David Sokol quit after reportedly buying 100,000 shares of Lubrizol stock before recommending that Berkshire buy the company. Diane Swonk is off this week. We're joined instead by Mayor Shields, an analyst with Stifel Nicolaus. Good morning.
Good morning.
So give us a sense, for those of us who do not work on Wall Street, why does this high-profile resignation at Berkshire Hathaway matter?
I think at this point in time, Warren Buffett is clearly a celebrity CEO, and Berkshire Hathaway is a celebrity company, if such a thing exists. So when you've got something that at least carries the appearance of impropriety at a company which is a household name, then it's interesting, and I think it's something that people want to talk about.
So it's the issue of Berkshire Hathaway is seen as a very transparent company normally, and this sort of changes that a bit?
Yes, Berkshire Hathaway has developed over the decades a very solid reputation for honesty, and then people look at the story and say, well, maybe that doesn't look right.
What about the succession issue? I mean, why was everybody expecting this guy to be the successor, and what does it matter if he's not?
Well, those are two great questions. I think people were expecting David Sokol to be the successor because he was one of very few CEOs within the Berkshire empire that got moved around. He was the CEO of an energy company, and when the airline company, NetJets, got into trouble, he was the person that was sort of put in to repair that. And he's also made some significant high-profile recommendations for the investment portfolio. So from the outside, he looked to be the most likely person who was being groomed to take over for Warren Buffett. The reason it matters, I think, is because we've had over the past decade a number of, again, iconic CEOs of huge companies, AIG, GE, Citigroup, and when that iconic CEO left and was replaced with someone, then the stocks did very poorly, and there were a lot of unfortunate surprises that had sort of been hidden from the public.
And now we're watching places like Apple with Steve Jobs and Rupert Murdoch over at News Corporation for some possible more succession plans to come out. Mayor Shields of Stifel Nicolaus, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Number of people seeking first-time jobless benefits dropped last week to 388,000. That is more good news on the jobs front ahead of tomorrow's big March employment report.
Meanwhile, a study out today from Fidelity Investments finds retirees will need 8% less money this year to cover medical expenses. Fidelity is attributing that first drop in 10 years to the fact that seniors will get more help with out-of-pocket medical expenses because of the new health care law.
Looking for more numbers? They're all at our website, the numbers section at marketplace.org.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, March 31st. I'm Steve Chiatakis on Twitter, by the way, at Radio Chio.
I'm Jeremy Hobson on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson. Now let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? Computer giant Microsoft, which is often the target of antitrust allegations, is filing a suit of its own, an antitrust complaint against Google in Europe, claiming Google is strangling search engine competition. The European suit could be a precursor to a similar complaint against Google in the United States, the BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
European regulators have been formally investigating Google since last November, when four smaller rivals complained that the search giant was manipulating search results. The news today is that Microsoft has joined the complaint. But the move isn't without irony. Microsoft itself was the target of a decade-long spat with Europe's anti-competition regulators, and in the end paid over $1 billion to Europe, at the time a record fine for an individual company. But now the boot is on the other foot, and Microsoft is claiming to be the underdog. Rupert Goodwins is editor of technology website ZDNet UK. He says he's not surprised by the move.
Microsoft has failed completely to make any headway against Google, in Europe in particular, on the online search market.
If found guilty, Google could, in theory, be fined millions or even billions of dollars, maybe approaching or surpassing the record fines once paid by Microsoft. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
Well, today could be another critical day for Europe as it grapples with its debt crisis. Authorities in Ireland will unveil just how healthy, or unhealthy perhaps, Irish banks are as part of a new round of bank stress tests. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us to talk about it this morning. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Now, we reported months ago that Ireland was bailed out. Why are we back here again?
Well, yes, it was bailed out with loans from the EU and the IMF, and the Irish government has already pumped a lot of this bailout money into its banks. But this clearly isn't enough. The banks need more capital, and it's expected to be revealed today that they need an extra $40 billion. If that is the case, it'll mean that Ireland will have eventually pumped a staggering 45% of its GDP into its banks, almost half the country's entire output for a year.
And where's this all headed, Stephen?
Well, the bailout money is borrowed by the Irish government, so investors are now fretting about the government's debt at a time when the country's in recession, unemployment's almost 15%, government revenues are falling. The worry, says Peter Tarl Larson of the financial website Breaking Views, the worry is that Dublin won't be able to repay the loans or perhaps even pay the interest on the loans.
The suspicion is that if Ireland can't do that, that it will have to, at some point in the next year or two, restructure its debts as well.
And that means not paying some of it back?
That means not paying some of it back.
And that's the ultimate fear, that Ireland will default and investors will stop lending to this and perhaps other governments in the Eurozone.
All right, Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
Some customers to a New York City restaurant are crying foul, Jeremy, over an extra charge that appeared on their bill for ice.
Charging for ice?
Yes, they're charging for ice. The New York Daily News and this website, Eater.com,
yeah,
reports the bar at the Darby
tax
on $2 for each drink served on the rocks.
That doesn't make any sense. Why would you want to pay more for a drink with less alcohol in it?
And for that matter, you're going to pay more for something that's going to melt and water down your drink.
I'll tell you what I would do to that bartender, Steve.
What?
Ice him. Smirnoff ice him.
Oh, my goodness. From your mouth to God's ear.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, March 31st. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. There's a hearing in the House of Representatives today looking at plans to renovate or tear down, depending on your perspective, the once mighty mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, this comes just as regulators are figuring out new rules to make mortgages safer, as required by the financial reform law.
Marketplace's Economy 4.0 project is looking at the ways the financial system can better serve more people. And our special correspondent, David Brancaccio, joins us now from New York. Good morning, David.
Morning, Jeremy.
So first of all, David, tell us how the new financial reform law impacts the world of mortgages.
Here's a concept. Skin in the game. If you're a lender, you want to make a mortgage, you should have some of your own capital at risk. Mm-hmm. If you have some of your own money at risk, maybe you'll be less likely to gamble. But there are loopholes.
Loopholes already? This law is brand new.
Well, you don't have to have skin in the game for a so-called safe mortgage. That's if you do an old-school 20% down payment loan, like in the old days.
Uh-huh.
But the other big loophole is, if the mortgage is backed by the mortgage giant Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, then you don't have to have a skin in the game.
But Fannie and Freddie are likely to undergo some changes themselves, right?
The subject of a lot of discussion on Capitol Hill, even as we speak. Yeah, Freddie and Fannie implicated in the entire mortgage meltdown. Many Republicans just hate those quasi-government institutions. I think Senator John McCain once said that their taxpayer-backed slush funds, we've put about $134 billion in taxpayer money into those things. And so in the House of Representatives, there were eight bills this week introduced that will either slowly or more quickly phase out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and reduce their influence and power in the mortgage market.
And David, what does all of this mean for people who might be looking for a mortgage right now?
Well, there are progressive liberal groups who are quite concerned about the full demise of Fannie and Freddie, saying it could lead to things like the end of the 30-year fixed mortgage, which might be of concern to many people. But even the Obama administration is talking about significant changes to both those institutions, Republicans and the administration not that far apart. The question is, really, how quickly this all happens, Jeremy.
Marketplace's David Brancaccio in New York. Thanks, David.
My pleasure.
At baseball stadiums across the country today, we're going to hear the sounds of cracking bats and songs about Cracker Jack and rooting for the home team. I love it. In Tampa Bay, Florida, that team is the Rays. For years, losers of games and of money. But a new book chronicles how the team's owners, these are former big bankers, turned it all around. Jonah Carey wrote The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You write about the Tampa Bay Rays and how they gave teams with big payrolls a run for their money. This sounds a lot like Moneyball, right? The book where the Oakland A's figured out some of the stats that were undervalued and then exploited that. How are the Rays different?
I think it's a little bit more nuanced. It's being 2% better than the competition in everything that they do. That's what their owner, Stuart Sternberg, who comes from Goldman Sachs, that's his belief. So we're talking about everything from signing players to contracts below market value, hiring a better manager, to marketing, and how are their ushers, and should they have more post-game concerts than the next guy? They're really thinking about things from that perspective. It's a more holistic approach, I would say, and again, a more subtle approach.
How did the owners of the Rays figure out the keys to financial and on-the-field success?
They came in and said, hey, you know, we come from the world of Wall Street. there are things that that are applicable that can work out. And so one of the lessons that they took to heart was something called arbitrage. On Wall Street, it's taking two similar assets. You're buying one, you're selling the other, and you're benefiting. You're getting a little bit of a profit. And so in baseball terms, the general principle is the same. You're making this small little deal for a utility infielder or a B-level prospect or a relief pitcher. These pieces that don't seem all that huge, but collectively they add up to a whole lot.
I want to talk about the institution of baseball and how it became this game of teams that are winners because they have money and teams that are losers because they don't. The first thing that comes to mind for me is are the Yankees, right?
It's always been that way. It's just that as more revenue has come into the game, the gulf has widened. That's why it's so compelling. In 2008, the Tampa Bay Rays had a $43 million payroll. Red Sox were about $140 million, and the Yankees were about $210 million, five times more than the Rays. Rays knocked them off anyway. That is a compelling underdog story. You are beating the biggest, baddest teams in the sport. And then they did it twice in 3 years. They came back and did it again in 2010.
Jonah Carey, author of The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First. It was fun. Thank you, Jonah.
Thank you.
Steve, it's one thing for a company to track your clicks as you browse its website, but what about tracking your emotions? Seems like a step too far. This week in San Francisco, scientists demonstrated new technologies aimed at getting inside our heads. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
Rosalind Picard is a scientist at MIT's Media Lab and the co-founder of a startup called Effectiva. The company is teaching computers to recognize human emotions. The idea is to give online marketers a sense of how shoppers are responding to their products or pitches.
One way to think about it is, hey, if you were in our store, we'd be able to see, like, if you were looking confused or interested or like you needed help.
But if you're shopping online or streaming a video, the company on the other end of those wires doesn't know if you're amused, annoyed, or bored, or on the verge of closing the deal. So Picard and Effectiva created a web app that can watch you while you surf, a computer that tracks human emotions through a webcam.
If you're willing to turn on your webcam and let us see that, we'll try to offer you better service.
Successful salespeople know how to read their customers. Soon, they could let computers do it for them. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Well, the diner restaurant chain Denny's isn't relying on any fancy computers to get our emotions going. It is reverting to an old standby, bacon.
Bacon!
The chain has launched a big ad campaign for what it's calling Baconalia, which is a whole menu of bacon-filled items. Here are a few of my favorites.
Okay.
Bacon meatloaf, bacon flapjacks, the triple bacon sampler, and of course, the maple bacon ice cream sundae for dessert.
Okay, two things.
Yeah.
The bacon, the triple bacon sets. So there are three ways they prepare bacon?
I guess.
What do they boil it? What kind of preparation are they doing with the bacon?
You know, there was nothing open early enough for me to go out and have bacon, so I didn't want to actually look at pictures of it and get hungry. But the marketing chief for Denny's told Advertising Age, no chain has embraced bacon like we have. Fair statement, I think.
Yeah.
And we truly believe the bacon trend is here to stay. And I, for one, Steve, embrace that.
I think you should. I didn't realize the bacon trend had gone anywhere,
though.
We were always liking bacon.
Although, I will say, maple bacon ice cream sundae seems a bit too far for me.
I'm not sure about that. It would melt the ice cream, wouldn't it, if it were really hot?
It's possible. You're thinking about all the contingencies. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.